I'm Jamal, and you're listening to Gas in the Mecha, your weekly anime and manga analysis podcast. From inspiring arcs to game-changing cinematography, I'm on a journey to try and make sense of it all, episode by episode. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to another episode of Gas in the Mecha, and in this week's episode, we're doing the thing where I talk about something really niche and in a lot of detail, and this time we're talking about water in anime. And I want to kind of conceptualize it as a visual tool, or just a tool more than anything else. Often water, as well as just any other sort of visual tool or metaphor, you can even argue it's a written tool in a lot of ways as well, which we will cover. It's used to communicate a message. It's a vehicle for saying or commenting on a thing, and that is why it really counts and why it's worth paying attention to. Overall, water in the real world is extremely versatile, and it's the exact same case in filmmaking and animated filmmaking, where writers, be it those who write the source material for whatever thing it is, as well as the directors of said adaptations or original works, they harness it for their own storytelling purposes. And this week we're going to look at quite a few examples of how that's done, and then talk about how that can kind of teach us about visual metaphors and teach us about, I guess, visual storytelling. So let's dive right into this episode. That is episode 100, and I don't even remember now. But yeah, here's the episode for this week. A look into water in anime. As we are talking about water in this episode, I thought it would be best to kind of model this episode off of an iceberg. I'm gonna be completely honest, I've never watched an iceberg video explained before. I know what they are vaguely, don't get me wrong, but I've never actually watched one. So I don't think this is going to be according to the iceberg format as you usually get in on YouTube. But I think it's cool to structure it like an iceberg, one, because it just matches really well with the theme of water, and also it just works really well for how we're doing things. And as I said, this isn't an iceberg explained video, nor is there really a deeper way or the most deep way to use water as a visual tool or written tool, but I just kind of like how we're going to kind of scale down and see how far you can really push this. And so this week, we are kind of structuring this episode into three sections. The first one is going to be looking at water as an active force. The second is going to be looking at water as a passive barrier of sorts. And then the third one is going to be looking at it as a passive medium. Keep in mind that these categories are much more loose than I kind of structured them. So there might be some things that fit into one category that also fit into another, or even all three. The last example certainly fits into all three. And many of them do sort of dabble between them. It's just really so we can have like some sort of coherent discussion rather than me talking about like all the elements of the taxonomy together. So let's begin this exercise and look at water as an active force to begin with. And so what I think really defines this category or this way of presenting water is often how it has to do with a subject being affected by said water. It's water doing something to a certain character, and there's often a sense of physicality to it as well to represent said friction or force of the water. But I think what the best stories do, though, as we will see, is that it often mixes up how it uses water in the physical sense to either obstruct or perhaps assist the character engaging with it. And that kind of leads us to our first example, which is The Great Passage. The Great Passage originally was a novel written by Shimomura, and that was adapted into an anime, and that has series composition by Taki Sato, and also was directed by Toshimasa Kurionagi. I won't go too deep into the story because that's not the central part of it, but I do need to give a bit of necessary context. And for those who don't know, The Great Passage is a narrative about dictionary making, and well, as you can probably guess, is a very long process, and also something happening a lot less now because the internet has become a big tool for searching words. And so in order to represent this journey, it's visualized in this dream space, essentially, where our main character Benjamin is often transported mounted, and on he's standing on one side, and then there's often a wheel on the other, but in the middle of it there's this massive, I guess, ocean or sea. The water here represents words. There is a sea of words, an ocean of words, which is kind of blocking him from the wheel. And the grand metaphor of the Great Passage is essentially the fact that you need a boat, which is the dictionary, to get to the other side, and that boat is the dictionary that assists its readers throughout their entire lives to kind of get to grips with the world. To touch on what I was trying to get at earlier, though, I think what's really beautiful about it is that it presents itself as antagonistic. This is done in one of the earlier episodes, as well as the opening as well. The water is something that one can drown in. One can be overwhelmed by words and information. And I think that's really powerful, just because I think that that's something that we all really experience. But seeing that physically, I think, changes the entire dynamic of it. You can see him being overwhelmed by it because, you know, his face is being pushed back against the water. But by virtue of it being a force, it can also be controlled and resisted, which I also really love. And as the characters grow in this journey to write this dictionary, which they then label the Great Passage, this, I guess, metaphorical ocean of words changes too. There's one point in the show where they do enter this space, and the water's much more shallow, and they can actually work their way through it, which is, again, pretty optimistic. As we'll see later into this episode, the best usages of a tool like water, I think, are those that constantly adapt to the context in which they're in. I think it shows a lot of dedication and just a lot of skill on the part of a writer or director, or writer and director, to commit to a single idea and really make it work for themselves in different ways. And The Great Passage is a really good example, and just one of quite a few. I really love how it creates this focal message that the series can, it gives it a memorable identity. And that's, I think, the core of these visual tools, ultimately. It gives us something to latch onto, as opposed to having loads of different dispersed messages that we'll have to think about separately. You have one core thing that you can buy into. And The Great Passage is just one, again, of quite a few examples, as we'll look at in this episode, that really adds to the identity and the focal message of the anime they come from. I think a very similar thing can be said for March Comes In Like a Lion as well, which uses water in a kind of similar way, and also very well, and this is best reflected in its openings. There are so many other examples throughout the show, because it's probably the main metaphor for most of the show, and the main tool in which it uses. Water is the main tool in which it uses, but let's just focus on the OPs for now, or else we'll be here for a very long time. We have the first opening, which is storyboarded and directed by Naoyuki Asano, and the compositing overall is, or the photography of it all, is very quite noisy, and that it looks almost as if it's painted with these very murky and quite dark watercolors. And that being mixed with the actual physicality of the water presented in the opening, which is drowning the main character Ray, I think goes a long way to making the water appear not particularly antagonistic, but corrupting, as it swallows everything and swallows him and surrounds him completely, and also swallows the fragments of what looks like his past life, where you see all these chairs and seats down below on like the bed of the ocean or on the bottom of the body of water. But then that's almost diametrically opposed with opening three, which is brought in and directed by the one and only Ryosuke Nakamura, and opening four as well, which is handled by Nobutaka Yoda, as well as Kazuya Shiotsuki. And the water here is interacted with completely differently. What's really cool in opening three is where Ray can actually run across the water, in comparison to, of course, before, where he's drowning. He can't handle it at all. It's completely consumed him, and now he's the one making the impact on it. So you see there's one scene where he's splashing onto the water. He makes an impact on the thing which was once drowning him. And in the same way, you also have like this glass that stood across the water. It's like, I found that shot really powerful, because it's like, it's almost as if this past life isn't something that we've completely gotten over. Yeah, we can walk on it, but it's a part of us. We still have to interact and engage with it, but it's still very much there. and with us. The water isn't particularly coercing him anymore, but in fact, it's a springboard for him to, explore new things and to become a better person than he once was. And then in opening four, we use water again pretty differently, where it's represented as puddles and also as this downpour of rain. Its physical state isn't particularly threatening anymore, even though it does still have a pretty dark mood to it. But something I was thinking about was how, with all the flowers in the opening and this less threatening form of water, downpour of water, that it really could speak to the idea of growth and the fact that in order for a flower to grow, as well as sun, which it needs, and March comes in and constantly is using light in its openings as this ray of hope almost. But it also needs rain as well in order to grow. And so I was thinking that if we were to bring rain into this analogy and view rain as a flower, water representing his grim past, the sun representing this almost optimistic future, that it's almost a necessary thing for him. He needs the rain. He needs the dark past in order to grow. He needs those things which were hanging on to him and keeping him back in order to progress, because you know what you're trying to, leave behind and get better from. And so I really like all of these different presentations of water in March Comes in Like a Lion's openings, and I think it does contribute a hell of a lot to how we understand the show. So just to end this section, I think this much more active presentation of water really shouldn't be perceived as basic, because it honestly all depends on how you make use of it, like anything, like all tools. And I think those involved in handling these openings, for example, these shows, have a really great grasp of that and give these shows a really great central identity to work with. Let's move this on a bit and look at water as a passive barrier. And I think this one's pretty different to the other one, where the physicality of it matters, but not particularly in the active sense that it is physically obstructing the characters in the active sense. So you don't have water drowning the characters and pushing them back, and it's worth overcoming. It's more the optics that matters, and the fact that there's a body of water there and present that is perhaps restricting, or just it just looks overwhelming as opposed to it physically being overwhelming. So I'm not going to spend too long in this section, because there aren't so many examples that I think can beat this one, and it's the ocean scene in Attack on Titan. Of course, if you haven't got to Attack on Titan Season 3 Part 2, what are you doing? But probably skip this section, even though I'm sure you probably saw in the timestamps, but this is probably the most famous example, and I still think the best example out there. So of course, credit to Isayama, but also just the entire anime team as well, for those who handled the material for this part. There were quite a few people. Attack on Titan's conclusion to the return to Shiganshina really grapples with this notion of the invisible and foreign enemy by the end, where we kind of go back into this realist dilemma that Attack on Titan explores, where you never really know when an attack is coming. And so it's does that justify us going to attack them first, or do we not do that? And that's the really weird insecurity. And I think the thing that's probably most powerful about Attack on Titan's conclusion, where you don't really know what is there, at least if you haven't read the manga, you don't really know what is on the other side. It's just a thing, or there's somebody there that could potentially destroy us as well. It really makes your mind wonder, because especially as me being an anime only, by that time, all you really know is that there is potentially someone across the ocean that is scheming for the downfall of the characters in which we're seeing right there. You can't see who it is. You don't see anything there. It's just a body of water. And that's what makes it really threatening, despite the water itself not actually being it's not doing anything. They're cupping it in their hands and everything. They're interacting with it very nicely. The water isn't the problem. It's just the fact that it's a very long and what feels like almost infinite body of water, but it obviously ends somewhere, and there's something pretty bad on the other side. So I guess the water in this case again, serves as optics. It's the feeling that there's something on the other side without actually knowing it's there. And the water just works as a barrier to separate the two parties, I guess. I suppose if we're to return to the Great Passage, that fits really well into this as well. The water separates the characters from the wheel. It's essentially all the problems that the dictionary is meant to solve. The water is the barrier that stops people from really exploring the world as much as possible and engaging with it as much as possible because they're obstructed by the very complicated nature of information and words, which we will have to get to grips with in order to communicate in society. I think the water as a barrier example speaks to the idea that the mere presence of something on screen can just have a really big effect. I didn't really have much to say on this besides the fact that I really love that scene. It's probably the best scene in Attack on Titan, in my opinion. And yeah, I just want to slot it into the middle of this like taxonomy thing we have going. Now onto our final section, which is viewing water as a passive medium. And by medium, I really mean a visual metaphorical device that's used almost as a form of transportation, moving a character or a character going through it to get from A to B. And they might not necessarily battle against it per se, but it's often to bring two things together. The key thing here is the fact that it kind of has a degree of liminality in how it's in the middle, or it's almost a transitionary sort of thing. In order to explore this example, we're going to be looking, of course, at Shogun Rakugo Shinju, which we spoke about not very long ago, and a all-time classic and friend of the show at this point, Heike Monogatari. It's not a big part of Rakugo, but it's still there nonetheless. And I think it's almost co-opted to speak about this notion of descent. It's probably the main metaphor of a lot of the language and imagery in Rakugo Shinju, this notion that Yakumo's descending into hell as a result of his past, and Miyukichi having the same experience. And she hits us, of course, with one of the best lines in the anime: next time we meet we'll be in hell. But back to water, though. I think this is best displayed in Rakugo Shinju's opening. So if we take opening 1, storyboarded and directed by Tokiyuki Masatake, the cuts are very simple, but it's super well done. And what happens here is that Miyukichi is drifting down the water as things in her life become, I guess, worse, you could say, and things start to get the best of her. She's being dragged slowly but surely by the water into, I guess, hell. But it's not in this antagonistic way. She's kind of, again, just drifting down herself. And then in opening 2, storyboarded by Mamoru Hatakeyama and directed by Nobukage Kimura, we get a pretty similar vibe where this notion of descent is used quite prominently, where Yakumo falls off the cliff and then he dives into the water, which is basically his ticket to hell. But overall, I think the use of water and Rakugo as a medium, I think, is really just to accompany the descending imagery. And it's, I think this is a really cool use of a visual metaphor where it's not particularly the main thing. It's not the standout focus of the series or the one in which it tries to make its central and most foremost identity, but it's almost co-opted into a larger scheme of the metaphor, or at least its visual metaphors. Of course, this is a great segue to talk about Heike Monogatari, which also has this dynamic between water and hell as well. Water in Heike Monogatari, in my view, functions almost as this liminal space. It's the medium by which one travels to reach the depths of hell or the afterlife. And most of the deaths in the show involve people drowning or at least sinking through water. And of course, the prophesized death of Tokuko at the beginning of the show is her drowning after being sucked in by a whirlpool. But where this gets super interesting is how Heike's very early establishment of water as a danger through this prophesied death leads to this trickle-down effect where everything almost instantly, we recontextualize water almost in its entirety because it's understood as a danger now, and we view it as a dangerous and threatening thing, or at least one, something with extremely dark consequences and things attached to it, of course, because it's the ticket to hell. It's the way, it's the route to get there. And so, of course, everything we view now that has water involved, we're going to have hell in our minds, or at least that's kind of what I've come to think about it now, or how I think about it now. This allows us, of course, to recontextualize a lot of the natural imagery in Heike beyond its just literal meaning. There are battles which take place on water, if not near it. It's used as a resting space as well, and it's even for just flowers to travel across, which have a whole meaning in themselves. But it's a vulnerable space where characters are always on edge, I think, or it's just, we're always looking at what's prophesized to be their fate, being, you know, the fall of the Heike clan. We're always looking at the danger because it's constantly with us. It surrounds and dominates the imagery of this entire show. Calling it a medium almost isn't enough, and that's why I wrote in my notes at one point that this is almost the like super mega hybrid example of using water in an anime, because it has so it's literally everywhere. We are always submerged and surrounded by death, basically. We're constantly surrounded by this fate that we are going to all eventually die and fall to hell and sink in it and eventually just burn up, I guess. I'd say Heike almost transcends the idea of it being purely a tool or feeling like a tool, because it's more than that. It's a physical inevitability. It's a part of the way in which we live and how we interact with the world. And that involves interacting with water, or at least being near it. Life and death are ultimately two sides of the same coin, and what it means to live life is also what it means to be close to death and always vulnerable to it. And so I think mapping it to a physical space is just a really great way of doing this, by giving it an identity, giving death an identity, basically giving hell an identity that again isn't just purely hellfire, I think makes it much more tangible when we're looking at the real world, or at least a world that is meant to feel somewhat real. To be fair, I'm not surprised though, because this is Naoko Yamada, and as I've blabbed on about for ages in other episodes, namely the lenses episodes, in a Yamada show, the metaphors are extremely layered, and she pushes these visual devices to their limits, essentially, and ensures that they're layered and worth thinking about. You can't really just, like, I think with Heike Monogatari especially, we also looked at A Silent Voice as well, you can't really attack it from just the surface layer alone, because it will have five different layers in which all add up to this bigger metaphor about, again, we spoke about silence and that notion of visual silence at one point, and water as well, and the drowning feeling of silence, or the physical feeling of silence. And it's the same with Heike Monogatari, this whole idea of hell and water being the ticket to hell, how that attaches itself to flowers and plants and everything. It's incredibly profound, and I think it becomes much more than just, you know, an 11 episode anime that you watch on a seasonal basis, but almost a, well, I would call it a profound masterpiece that can be contemplated and analyzed for ages, because there are all of these seeds and layers planted into this show. So I think that's a really big and valuable part of visual metaphors. And water, in this case, is an example of this. It's the fact that we can't attack it from one perspective, because it's often layered and, I guess, injected with so many meanings that we have to constantly think about them and update our understandings of them. And that's what keeps a show like Heike Monogatari alive, at least, in the metaphorical sense. It's kind of hard to me for me to argue that it's alive in fandom, in the fandom context, but at least it's alive in the sense that it's full of metaphors and layers to it. And to understand water, we have to understand so many other things as well. My main argument for this whole episode, and really why I wanted to look into Warsaw, was just to prove that these visual tools are really worth looking into. And on top of that, they're just really, and often they are multifaceted. Even when looking at the more active approaches, one can see that there are so many layers beyond just something being physical. There are so many metaphorical things in play, and I think that obviously applies to the other half of stuff we spoke about as well. All of these examples have really shown how layered things can get, basically, and that you shouldn't really take most things, I think, on a very two-dimensional basis, because there are often multiple layers in play. There are multiple dimensions, I should say, in play that add to the meaning of said thing and can really elevate how we view something and an element of a show or a book or whatever. And Water is just a really good example to show that that's the case, that nothing, I'd say, in art is two-dimensional, and purely two-dimensional, and should be analyzed purely on a two-dimensional basis. There are so many dynamics in play that I think are thought about that are worth acknowledging, partially to, I guess, respect the artist, of course, and the work they maybe put into constructing these, but also just to engage your mind in them as well, because they're really interesting to think about as well. I know some people do complain about people overreading into things, and I've had people tell me this in either a direct way or just a roundabout way, that, you know, you're thinking too much about this. Oh, like, this wasn't worth thinking about, like, it's not that deep, or something like that. But I think we should give both artists and creators, and also just ourselves, a bit more credit sometimes. And like, animation is such an it's so intentional of a medium, in the sense that, like, pretty much everything you see on screen is been thought out in one way or another by one person, be it the person that read the source material, be it the person who directed the show themselves. Everything is thought about. And so I think, again, we should give credit to the thought process in which they used to get there. I don't know if I did it that intentionally, but I used this Water episode to kind of prove the idea that one should really, like, try to engage in the details that come with art, because there's so much to explore in it. And I don't think artists contemplate on these things or construct these things for us to just kind of say whatever and not think about them, because there's so much there. You'll definitely have a much more, I'd say, engrossing experience if you try and test out these things. And Water is just sort of one avenue to explore how deep these things can get overall. So thank you for listening to yet another episode of Guest in the Mecca. I hope you did take something from this, as messy as it was. And if you want to support the podcast, just the usual things, of course, leave a review on Apple Podcasts as well as Spotify. If you leave a worded review on Apple Podcasts, by the way, I will read it at the beginning of the episode as a way of saying thanks. So keep that in mind, and hopefully that's an incentive to review the show. And then, of course, you can subscribe on YouTube as well, and press the bell if you don't want to miss stuff, I guess. Do what you want, basically. I don't really know what to say to that. But yeah, thank you for listening, and I will see you on yet another, or just on another episode of Guest in the Mecca. The music in this episode goes as follows: Chill, Adventure Time Revised, On the Road Again, and Synthwave by Alex. And all this music is done by Alex McCulloch and is under the public domain.